From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! More Russian troops are headed to Kosovo as the original 200 continue to hold the airport at Pristina. Another pro-Milosevic rally in Belgrade. We'll find out what's happening with anti-Milosevic dissidents in exile. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Armed, uniformed ethnic Albanians have moved into Pristina, the capital of Kosovo, where their commander yesterday rejected a UN resolution calling on the guerrillas to disarm. Rashdan Mustafar, known by his nom de guerre Remy, told the Financial Times and his new headquarters that the goal of the Kosovo Liberation Army was to transform itself into the army of an independent state of Kosovo. Remy said NATO had not asked him to disarm his force and that he expected to meet Lieutenant General Sir Mike Jackson, the British commander of the K-4 peacekeeping force, soon. U.S. Marines and other NATO troops spread out over Kosovo today as convoys of Yugoslav soldiers and Serb civilians straggled out of the battered province. Ethnic Albanian rebels quietly moved in as well, taking positions vacated by departing Serbs. Russia, meanwhile, sent an 11-vehicle convoy from Bosnia to resupply its troops at the airport in Pristina, the capital of Kosovo. Russian control of the airport has caused an embarrassing diplomatic standoff as Western nations struggle to reach an agreement with Russia over its role in the massive peacekeeping mission. Yugoslav police are expected to pull out most of their forces from the Pristina area today under terms of the peace agreement that calls for all police, paramilitaries and soldiers to be out of Kosovo by Sunday night. NATO officials said about 15,000 Allied troops, known under the operation name KFOR, had entered Kosovo as of yesterday, including 1,200 U.S. Marines. A high seas confrontation between North and South Korea escalated yesterday when Southern warships sunk one Northern vessel and badly damaged at least one other in a clash in the Yellow Sea. While South Korea blamed the Northern ships for the 10-minute exchange of gunfire, the North Korean state news agency accused the South of a deliberate provocation that drives the two Koreas to the brink of war. It demanded an apology for the shooting. Ships from the two sides have been confronting each other since June 8th, when North Korean warships began sailing in and out of a disputed rich crab fishing area. Yesterday's shooting came less than an hour before the U.S.-led UN command met with Northern generals in a bid to defuse tensions. The Indonesian government this weekend said Nobel laureate José Ramos Horta will not be allowed into East Timor to campaign ahead of a UN-monitored poll there as he plans. Jakarta, in a statement issued by the foreign ministry, also lamented a statement by the spokesman of the UN mission to East Timor, David Wimhurst, saying Horta, an exiled East Timorese leader, would be free to come and campaign ahead of the polls. Horta recently said he planned to return to Dili next month after more than 23 years' absence, with or without official permission. A panel to recommend whether war games should continue on the island of Vieques in Puerto Rico was created by Defense Secretary Bill Cohen and Navy Secretary Richard Danzig. The move came after the Navy temporarily halted weapons practice on the 21-mile-long island. There have been numerous protests at a Navy base there since two Marine jets mistakenly dropped bombs on an observation tower April 21st, killing one civilian and injuring three others, as well as a Navy officer. New York's Roman Catholic bishops called on the governor and the New York State legislature to overhaul New York's stiff drug laws, saying they've filled the state's prisons with addicts who would be better served in drug treatment programs. In a two-page statement, the New York State Catholic Conference, the lobbying organization for the state's Catholic bishops, also said the law's tough mandatory sentences had caused New York's prison population to swell at enormous public expense since their enactment in the early 1970s. And President Clinton and lawmakers are joining today to honor Rosa Parks with Congress's highest civilian medal. The 86-year-old heroine of the civil rights movement is to receive the Congressional Gold Medal in a Capitol Hill ceremony. In 1955, Parks refused to give up her seat on a Montgomery, Alabama bus to a white man. Her subsequent arrest led to a year-long bus boycott led by the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. Those events are widely seen as the start of the modern civil rights movement. And finally, in another step toward a run for the Senate, Hillary Rodham Clinton is setting up a New York bank account this week to accept contributions from supporters. This, according to her top aide, Harold Ickes. The former White House deputy chief of staff is advising Clinton on her under-construction campaign effort. He said the checks began coming in last week.
In the far-off land, Uncle Sam does the best he can.
Are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with the Continuing War and Peace Report. Let me read you a couple of articles that we've been gathering from newspapers around the country. In the Washington Post today, rebels act to assert influence in Kosovo, a front-page story. Armed ethnic Albanian guerrillas swept triumphantly into Prizren, fanning out into streets that were occupied by Serbian paramilitary forces just hours before, and reminding NATO peacekeepers that the rebels are bent on asserting a role in a new Kosovo. The arrival of about 300 uniformed Kosovo Liberation Army rebels in Kosovo's third largest city was welcomed by crowds of ethnic Albanian civilians who emerged from their homes to greet them, as one boy yelled, "Now Kosovo is ours." At the same time, another front page piece in a village, signs of a massacre, and this is from Kachanik, Yugoslavia. After British soldiers arrived on Saturday and secured the city, Melihate Shehu walked down a rocky path from the mountains and went straight to the cemetery. She carried a clump of roses for the grave of her brother Reshat, who she said was killed in an attack by Yugoslav troops April 9th that turned into a massacre. A British soldier asked Shehu why she was going there. Her answer alerted NATO troops to the existence of an alleged mass grave site containing as many as 100 bodies, the first massacre site discovered by NATO since its forces arrived in Kosovo during the weekend. And this article from the New York Daily News says defeated Serbs are being pushed out of their sacred Kosovo on the anniversary of their 1389 defeat by the Turks, a legendary loss that remains the foundation of Serbia's national identity. The exact date of the battle is in question. Historian Noel Malcolm, who wrote the definitive account in Kosovo, A Short History, says it took place June 15th, 1389, which makes today the 610th anniversary. We're joined right now from Pristina, Kosovo, by Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent in the region. Jeremy, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Actually, I'm on the road coming out of an Albanian village called Rosovac, where I've spent most of the morning talking with residents there about ongoing attacks by Serb forces, the police and the military, the extensive looting that has continued as recently as just a few days ago, and also brutal attacks by paramilitary forces led by Arkin, the person who was leading the forces in Bosnia during an ethnic cleansing campaign there.
Can you talk more about what people in the village said?
Well, across the board, people tell a very similar story. They tell a story of how Serbian police officers and military have continued to loot their villages. I walked through an apartment complex today with residents in Rosovac, where they showed me doors that had been busted down, apartments that had been turned absolutely upside down. Bullet holes riddled the apartments of the residents there. And they also tell a story of very, very brutal and heinous crimes committed by Serbian paramilitary forces. They describe men with black masks bursting into apartments, opening fire in some cases, cutting throats in others, raping women in other cases. And they describe these men as wearing black masks, but also as wearing bandanas with a tiger on them. That is the mark of Arkin's paramilitary group, the Tigers. Now, Arkin has repeatedly said from Belgrade that he does not have his forces here, that he would only send them in the event of a ground invasion. Well, the testimony of multiple Albanians that I spoke to today in different circumstances, not only in Rosovac, but along the roads leading out of Pristina, were very consistent, and they all told a story of very, very brutal crimes committed by these paramilitaries.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy, can you talk a little about who Arkin is and his significance? I understand that he was indicted by the Hague War Crimes Tribunal.
That's right, Amy. And Arkin is known here. He has a reputation for having carried out an extraordinarily brutal campaign in Bosnia. He is known as a thug, as the cleanup man, as an exterminator, brought in when extreme and brutal force is, quote-unquote, necessary. There has been speculation that his troops were here because of the level of heinousness of the crimes being committed against ethnic Albanians, though no one has produced proof of that thus far, and Arkin has consistently, with journalists, denied that his forces are here. But based on the testimony of the ethnic Albanians that we did speak to today, they described soldiers wearing the outfits. And as a matter of fact, coming out of Rosovac yesterday, we did in fact see paramilitary troops dressed in the garb that residents have described as being that of Arkin's troops, the Tigers.
I'm just looking at The Serbs, History, Myth, and the Destruction of Yugoslavia, a very interesting book by Tim Judah, who we had on last week. And it says in 1994, a UN report identified 83 paramilitary groups fighting in Bosnia and Croatia, of which 56 were Serb, 13 Croat, 14 Bosnian Muslim. On the Serbian side, most were small and, although murderous, not particularly significant. Two, however, deserve special mention. They are Arkin's Tigers and the Chetniks of the extreme nationalist politician Šešelj. These groups played major roles as shock troops of ethnic cleansing, both in the autumn and winter of 1991 in eastern Slavonia and at the beginning of the war in Bosnia. The reason they became a necessity was twofold. First, Arkin's men, especially, were used as a form of brutal commando force whose incentive to venture where others feared to tread was the promise of loot. And then it says Šešelj's men were also fighting for pillage, but less specialized than Arkin's troops. They were used to make up dwindling numbers in the Yugoslav army. And it goes on from there.
Right, Amy. And Arkin actually has made his name here, and he's extraordinarily well known not only on the streets of Belgrade, but on the streets of Pristina here. As a matter of fact, you see his picture throughout Pristina, and I also saw his picture in Rosovac, ironically across the street from a KLA headquarters. He has made his mark by fighting in the front lines with his troops. He is there engaged in the same sorts of activities that they are, the same brutal sorts of things that they've been engaged in. And so he's developed a reputation as the cleanup man, as someone who comes in when extreme force is necessary. And the residents in the villages that I've talked to were petrified of these forces in particular. They say that the Serb police have been looting and also carrying out killings along with the Yugoslav army, but they attribute the most heinous crimes to the paramilitary forces, who they say have had a stronghold in villages throughout Kosovo, even to the present moment. People describe headquarters being in old factories in Rosovac, utilized by Arkin's men to come in and carry out burnings of homes and killings of people. One old man that I talked to today described a killing that just took place 5 days ago, where a father was killed in front of his children and wife, and then the children were killed as well. The old man described the outfits of them as being those of the Tigers.
We're talking to Jeremy Scahill, who's just come out of an Albanian village where Albanians were talking about where they're saying that Arkin, they saw the activity of Arkin's Tigers. Interestingly enough, talking about Arkin's history, and we can talk more about this when you're in a less mobile situation, Jeremy, but it talks about his record having robbed banks in Sweden, been convicted of armed robbery in Belgium, Holland, and Germany, but always managed to escape from prison. The Italian police still want him for an alleged murder in 74. Clearly, Arkin is no ordinary thief, though. Born in 1950, the son of an Air Force officer, a teenage delinquent, he devoted himself to a life of crime. It's believed his father, despairing of his son, asked contacts inside the Yugoslav Federal Secretariat for Internal Affairs, known as the SSUP, if they could sort the boy out. Apparently they could. They ran an espionage network for which Arkin, when not robbing banks, is widely reputed to have worked as a hitman carrying out political assassinations abroad. It was during this time that Arkin picked up his nickname, which was derived from one of his early forged foreign passports. He also came to the attention of the head of the SSUP. With a powerful patron like this, Arkin's multiple prison escapes began to look less remarkable, and then talks about him returning in the 1980s to Belgrade, where he kept up criminal activities as well as his activities with the Yugoslav Federal Secretariat for Internal Affairs. And it says, while officially a simple pastry shop owner, he suddenly emerged at the end of 1990 as the head of Delige, the official fan club of Belgrade's Red Star football team. And talks about how until Arkin was put in control, the fans have become increasingly prone to uncontrolled outbursts of violence, and goes on from there. Clearly a very feared figure throughout Bosnia.
Absolutely, Amy. And in fact, residents were telling us today that they fear that Arkin's forces are not withdrawing from their villages, and they fear further attacks, and they also fear fighting between these paramilitary forces as well as the KLA. We've seen an increased presence of the KLA openly. They say they're planning a march of thousands of KLA soldiers throughout the streets of Pristina this Friday. Already, as you read in the introduction, they have marched publicly and had a public presence elsewhere. Increasingly, you are seeing the KLA flag flying above buildings that they have turned into provisional headquarters. And it's interesting, I talked to the head of a brigade here in Pristina, a man named Salim Mustafa, yesterday in his headquarters, which is an old school in an Albanian neighborhood here. I was one of the few journalists that got in to see him. And during my conversation with him, he told me that he has an agreement with NATO that if they catch Serb forces, paramilitary police or the Yugoslav army, that they have the right to shoot them. And I asked him, does that mean, he said in self-defense, and I said, does that mean even if they're looting but they're not aiming guns at people or firing on people? And he said, yes, they have their routes to leave the country. They need to be out by midnight tonight. If they're not, they will be shot by us, and he said, or NATO.
This is extremely interesting, considering that the policymakers who are on television, like Madeleine Albright, William Cohen, are stressing that the KLA is going to be disarmed, or as they say, demilitarized, which does not mean taking away their weapons. But they've also said taking away their uniforms. And at first I thought, what difference does it make? What kind of clothes people wear? But interestingly, on the front page of the Washington Post, the description of the armed and uniformed KLA marching through Prizren.
Yeah, absolutely. And you see armed and uniformed KLA members in full view of NATO. I saw them yesterday operating their own checkpoints along a road moving south out of Pristina. Well, they were operating this checkpoint right across the street from British and American soldiers in full view. I talked with a soldier from Scotland today in Jarosevac, and I said, are you disarming the KLA? And he said, no, we're just telling them not to display their weapons publicly. But in fact, we have seen them displaying their weapons publicly, and NATO is playing on semantics. They're saying demilitarize rather than disarm. And the distinction, as far as I can tell from the U.S. and British military that I've talked to, is that they say they're going to be taking away the heavy armaments of the KLA, but they're going to leave them with their guns. So the fear on the part of Serb civilians is that there's going to be a sort of death squad that erupt here that was the KLA. Now, the KLA has its sights on being the police force here of Kosovo. Many Albanians have spoken in favor of that, saying that they would feel safer if that were the truth. But there are also Albanians who are afraid of the KLA, and they fear what they might do. Now, this all comes at the same time when these Serbian troops are supposed to be withdrawing. They're supposed to be out of Pristina by midnight tonight. We have seen clear evidence that they are doing that. We have talked to some soldiers who say that they are going home. But still, residents fear that as they leave, there will be increased attacks, increased burnings, and the looting that we have seen extensively throughout not only Pristina but other places. The apartment complex that I was in today had many doors that had been completely broken down. Televisions and cars were stolen, other technical equipment. People's houses were turned upside down. I actually traveled into Irosovac with a number of ethnic Albanians who were returning to their homes for the first time from Macedonia, and what they returned to were homes that were riddled with bullets, turned upside down, furniture ripped apart and cut apart with knives.
Jeremy
Scahill,
Jeremy, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. But when we come back, I want to ask you about Kachanik, where you were yesterday, the site of what some say may be a site of a massacre, of where mass grave was. We're talking to Jeremy Scahill, who's just come out of an Albanian village in Kosovo. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
December 1st, 1955, our freedom movement came alive. And because of Sister Rose, you know, we don't ride on the back of the bus no more. Sister Rose was tired one day after a hard day on her job, when all she wanted was a well-deserved rest, not a scene from an angry mob. A bus driver said, baby, you got to get up, cause a white person wants that seat. But Miss Rose said, no, not no more, I'm gonna stay right here and rest my feet. Yeah, thank you, Miss Rosa, you are the spark that started our freedom movement. Thank you, Sister Rosa Parks. Thank you, Miss Rosa, you are the spark that started our freedom movement. Thank you, Sister Rosa Parks.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as we continue with our War and Peace report. In just a minute, we're going to go to Washington to speak with Pacifica reporter Laura Flanders, who's just returned from Budapest, speaking with anti-Milosevic dissidents who are in exile in Hungary. But to finish up with Jeremy, who is in Kosovo, bringing us the daily War and Peace report that he has for so many weeks now. Jeremy, what about Kachanik?
Well, in Kachanik, which is south of Pristina, it's about a half hour, 45 minutes south of Pristina, I went there to where British forces say that they discovered, through the help of Albanians as well as members of the KLA, they say they discovered what they believe to be is a mass grave. And as you walk into this area, which they said was still booby-trapped and may possibly even had mines in it, you approach what was already an existing cemetery with many, many graves there. But then at the end of this cemetery, you see 81 fresh plots that were dug. And now what residents in the area there told the British forces was that that was a mass grave full of bodies that had been reformed by Serbian forces to give it the appearance of being part of this cemetery. Now, they have not exhumed the bodies, and so that cannot be verified at this point. Obviously, there is fresh digging that has gone on there. Obviously, there are a number of what appear to be individual graves, but one KLA member who was there with the British forces in full uniform, I might add, told reporters that if they dig it up, they will, in fact, find bodies in disarray and not in individual plots. They claim that Serb forces formulated these plots to appear as though it was just part of the graveyard.
One of the things we're reading about, and these things need to be confirmed, is that after there are mass graves for a while to cover up war crimes, the Serb paramilitaries or military has either local Albanians or they themselves take the bodies out of the mass graves and have individual graves dug in local cemeteries. Is that what you're hearing?
Right, and that's the working theory right now as to what's happening with these mass graves, because the question arises that it takes a lot of manpower to do the sort of thing that they're saying Serb forces did, and it would take a lot of effort. But they say that the motivation for it is to try to cover up war crimes, to try to hide evidence of crimes from the investigators that will be coming into Kosovo soon. And so that is the sort of working theory as to why these mass graves are rearranged to appear as though they're part of a cemetery.
At the same time, we've gotten this report. Dutch peacekeepers today have discovered about 20 charred bodies in a village near the southwestern city of Prizren. A military spokeswoman says they are believed to be the remains of a mass execution of ethnic Albanians. Now, again, all of this has yet to be proved, but they do seem to be finding these bodies.
That's right, Amy. I mean, there are reports that file in consistently about these mass graves, but it is very, very difficult to confirm what exactly they are. And military spokespeople are very careful not to declare them mass graves straight out. They say that they're waiting for their forensics experts to come in. And those sorts of reports are filing in consistently as the troops spread out throughout Kosovo and move into various villages. Now, I think it's important to note, and we haven't said this before, but it certainly is worth mentioning, this is ostensibly a UN mission. Now, the only thing I've seen that's UN here is the UNHCR, the UN High Commissioner on Refugees. You do not see UN flags on the troops. You do not see UN flags on the vehicles. You see NATO flags, and this is very much a NATO operation. And so I think people are skeptical of what NATO says because they feel that they already came in here with an agenda. And so not only residents, but reporters, I think, are taking into account what they hear from these military spokespeople about various crimes that were committed. And I think people are waiting to see the evidence of this. But it does appear as though there are these mass graves throughout the country, but we have not gotten confirmation on that being exactly true.
Jeremy Scahill, I want to thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow. Jeremy Scahill reporting from Kosovo. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And take care, Jeremy. As we continue to look at what is happening in the Balkans, Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic made his second public appearance in as many days today, visiting a central Serbian town devastated by NATO missiles that went astray in April. Addressing several thousand people outside the town's damaged hospital, Milosevic said the NATO's worst crime committed in its air campaign against Yugoslavia took place in this community called Aleksinac, a small, impoverished town known for the fact that it gave more soldiers than any other in all wars we have fought, said Milosevic, especially in the Second World War. The biggest crime, he said, and the heaviest destruction hit this small, impoverished place. Yesterday, Milosevic stood in front of a bombed-out bridge near Serbia's second city, Novi Sad, the object of repeated NATO bombings, to launch post-war reconstruction after 11 weeks of NATO airstrikes, which ended last week. The crowd in Aleksinac today chanted, "Slobo, we are with you," and dozens waved Serbian and Yugoslav flags. Well, as those rallies take place in Yugoslavia, we're going to turn now to Hungary, to Budapest, where dissidents, anti-Milosevic dissidents, have fled and are now in exile. We're joined now by Laura Flanders. She's in our Washington studio. And Laura, Pacifica reporter, has just returned from Budapest, Hungary, where she spoke with some of these dissidents. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Laura.
Hi, Amy. You know, it's very interesting to look at the situation. Where do we go from here? We're hearing, obviously, about a peace. That's the language that's being talked about on the front pages of our papers. But there's really no peace been declared in any part of the former Yugoslavia, as far as I can see. Anything more than a cessation of a bombing war, I think, would really be overstating the case, particularly with what Jeremy reports about the situation vis-a-vis the KLA. The legacy now that we're left with is one of economic devastation, north and south. But when you look at Yugoslavia, we know that this has been just the kind of fertilizer that nationalists of various stripes have used to foment fury against ethnic and other minorities, including anti-patriots and people considered to be traitors. If you are in Budapest for even a moment, you find the people who concern themselves with these questions, like how do we go forward to build a civil society? People who've been trying to build civil society inside the former Yugoslavia for over 10 years. People who will tell you that 10 years ago they knew what direction Milosevic was going, but it was the way that Milosevic was treated by the international community, first and foremost the U.S., the most powerful member of that community, that gave them the wrong messages about what the world had in store for their leadership. They talk about the domestic cleansing that took place under the auspices of the NATO bombardment, which is really not so different from the ethnic cleansing, except in kind but not in force, that took place in Kosovo. And when you look to the future, as I mentioned, these are really the people that we need to hear from, but they're not the people who are there now left inside Belgrade. Most of them have fled. So, but I think that the words that you're going to hear next from some of those whom I spoke to in Budapest are a stinging indictment, really, of U.S. and NATO policy up to this point, and a call for some creative and new thinking about where to go from here, because as person after person told me, Milosevic to them is now stronger than he was in some ways, at least politically, before the NATO bombardment. And in this country, which, as you mentioned, Serbia, that celebrates its most heroic victory, I mean, its most heroic defeats, they pull in a glorious victory out of tragic defeat. The fact that Milosevic is already holding kind of triumphalist kind of protests, I think, is very frightening. I'm going to begin with an interview that I did with Nada Koric, who will identify herself, but she is a member of the faculty of the University of Belgrade. She's a psychologist, and she left the Yugoslav capital after the first week of NATO's bombing in order to be with her son, who lives with her ex-husband in Hungary. She's one of probably between 30 and 200,000 people from former Yugoslavia that are currently taking refuge in neighboring Hungary. And because it's the nearest town to Belgrade and Novi Sad, the majority in Budapest are from those two towns. Men of draft age are forbidden to leave Serbia, so it's mostly the women who do this border crossing. And you have to imagine the scene, Amy, that at night you hear, or at night when the bombing missions were restricted to the nighttime, these women would be listening to the skies and hearing the bombing missions, the planes taking off from Hungarian-based NATO bases to bomb their homelands, wondering where those missiles were going to fall and wondering really what their lives were going to be about now. This is Nada Koric.
Well, I'm a psychologist. I consider myself a professional. I also consider myself a citizen of the world, which does not make me less of a citizen of my own city. Since ex-Yugoslavia split apart, fell apart, actually, I feel as I have no homeland. It's just, you know, it would be like America without California and without Texas. And it's just there's no country that I grew up in and became an adult in. So I don't think I have a very strong attachment to the country as a whole, but I have a very strong attachment to my city, to Belgrade, and also to some other cities and to people.
Now, there are activists in Budapest who are doing very radical actions today, like smuggling human rights testimonies from Belgrade to The Hague. Nada Koric isn't one of those. She's somebody who feels that perhaps her activism was always her work. However, in 1997, when protests broke out in the streets of Belgrade and the other major cities of former Yugoslavia, Nada Koric was in the streets for those 3 months of the winter of 1997, cold winter days where the population of Belgrade, maybe 300,000 people every day took to the streets, maybe 500,000 taking the country as a whole. At that point, I asked her during those protests that she would attend almost daily, did the subject of Kosovo, did the subject of the Albanian minority come up? And this was her answer.
It came up, you know, every now and then. Of course, the situation then was not as it is now. But I clearly remember, and I think it's very important, was very important, one night when an Albanian man was killed he was a political prisoner, and he was beaten to death in a prison. And those were the news of that day. And that evening, when we were at the Republic Square, there must have been at least 100,000 people. And the speaker, one of the party leaders, said, it was Vuk Drašković, actually. He said an Albanian was today was beaten to death in Pristina prison. And regardless of whatever disputes we have with Albanians, this is not a way a citizen of Serbia, any citizen of Serbia, regardless of their nationality, should be treated. And this is what we're fighting for. And I really felt, you know, and he called for a minute of silence, and there was perfect silence. And I think that was one of the highest points of that protest. I thought at that moment that there was hope. You know, and I really feel, I was sure at that moment, you know, that we should all get together, the Albanians and the Serbs, and just get rid of the, you know, the dictatorship, which never happened, I don't know why, but I think that the influences which brought us apart were much, much stronger, and I think that those influences, at least on the Albanians, came, a lot of those influences came from abroad.
The demonstrations that Nada Koric, the psychologist from the University of Belgrade, is describing were brought together initially to protest voter fraud in the elections of that year. And the coalition that brought them together included radical nationalists, two progressive people, and Vesna Pesic's party, the Civil Alliance, was one of the members. The coalition, as Nada describes it, the coalition fell apart after those months of demonstrating. And her feeling was that there may have been agents provocateurs that helped that coalition fall, or it may simply have been exhaustion and the toll that it takes organizing demonstrations like that daily. The kind of exhaustion, the kind of toll that could have been mitigated by international assistance going to different members of the progressive forces, that international assistance did not come. There was nothing more than a public statement from the U.S. State Department deploring the voter fraud by the Milosevic regime. I asked her, you'll hear me ask her then, what message did it send? How were they left to understand their situation, given that the world that claimed to criticize Milosevic in some ways and at the same time continued to negotiate with him, for example, as at Dayton, turned away, in a sense, from handing them help, not a courage?
The world didn't help and continued instead to negotiate with Milosevic. What message did that send to you all at that time?
Nobody gives a damn. That was the message. They don't care. They just don't care. Of course, it improved our image in the world. But that, as you can see now, you know, that image is not worth two pennies. I mean, because now they're bombing the same people that protested there. And, you know, they're just left behind. They're forsaken. We who came here and those who stayed there, you know, there are many of them. Most of them stayed there. And we just feel abandoned, and nobody cares. It's not, we're not important. We don't exist.
The U.S. says, or the NATO mission says, that its agenda now is to drive the Serbian people to such a state of desperation that they will turn against their leader. Does that make sense psychologically? Is that a phenomenon that you have seen operate anywhere?
No, not that I know, not that I remember. I mean, of course they can, and you know, to say that they're not fighting against a nation or against a people, and they want to bring them, that bringing them into a state of desperation is a means, not an end, does not make any difference to a person who is driven into a state of desperation, you know. Now, they're telling them, okay, you know, it's not our means. It's not our end, you know, it's just the means. What difference does it make if you're without water, without food, without electricity? What difference does it make? It's, you know, I mean, those who have been against the leader are probably, you know, the leadership are probably against the leadership anyway. But others, I mean, it's really difficult to be sure that this desperation is not going to be directed in an unexpected direction. Of course, there will be resentment against the leadership, but there is a huge resentment against NATO, against, you know, all the all the values of Western civilization, which is wrong. I mean, Western civilization is not ideal, but it has its good sides. And now, you know, what was left of the belief that Serbia is a part of Europe, of Western civilization, is slowly falling apart.
You had said that throughout the last 10 years, people like yourself, critical of the government, were sent a message by the way that the world treated your leader that was misleading or confusing. Can you explain that for me? What was that message that you were sent?
Well, actually, you know, more than 10 years ago, many people realized where our government is leading. And if it did not get the treatment it got from the world, as because the world treated them as partners in negotiations, that was misleading for us, because we thought, well, then maybe, you know, they have a way of coming to terms somehow with them and, you know, making them do the things in a different way. And that was misleading, because, well, now we see that they didn't, you know, they negotiated when it was, I don't know, when it looked practical enough, and now that it doesn't look practical enough, they just decided to stop the whole thing and change their policy. And I could never predict that it was going to be this way. I thought that Western politicians knew what they were doing. Now I think they didn't, because if they knew what they were doing, then I would nothing remains but to believe in conspiracy, which I don't believe in. So I think that they were just acting mindlessly. I think that there's been a lot of mindlessness in whatever has been happening here.
That was Nada Koric, a psychologist at the University of Belgrade. And just as a final note, Amy, I think that while the papers and others are crowing about a solution to the situation or an end to the crisis in the Balkans, we have to talk and think about the future of these people who now return to their homeland, to their country, what is left of it, without even the securities that they had months ago of the networks that they had spent 10 years building, and without the infrastructure that protected them in some ways from the fury of their neighbors. Throughout the bombing, citizens were encouraged to spy on their neighbors, to identify people who were drawing the NATO missiles to their targets. The climate for activists like Nada Koric and the others whom I spoke to has only gotten worse, and I think as we talk about the heavy armament sent to Kosovo to bring peace, we have to also talk about what kind of help is going to be sent to these sorts of people who are really the only hope for progressive change in the former Yugoslavia.
Well, Laura, I want to thank you for being with us today, and we hope to bring our listeners a second part of your report on Yugoslav dissidents in Hungary later this week. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we wrap up our conversation with Pacifica reporter Laura Flanders, who's just returned from Budapest, Hungary, the latest addition to the NATO fold. Not Laura, of course, but Hungary. When we come back, we're going to turn to the issue of Russia and what is going on with the 200 troops in Kosovo, as well as the hundreds more that are being sent in to reinforce them at the Pristina Airport. Stay with us. are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia has sent an 11-vehicle convoy today from Bosnia to resupply its troops at the airport in Pristina, the capital of Kosovo. Russian control of the airport has caused an embarrassing diplomatic standoff as Western nations struggle to reach an agreement with Russia over its role in the massive peacekeeping mission. The Russian convoy includes paratroopers and supplies for the 200 to 300 Russian troops at the airport, this according to the Russian Defense Ministry. Meanwhile, NATO spokesperson Major David Scanlon says the new convoy has about 29 people. The surprise arrival of the Russian troops ahead of NATO has given Moscow greater leverage in negotiations over its place in the so-called peacekeeping force. So far, they've refused to let British troops enter the airport. Meanwhile, President Clinton spent 23 minutes on the phone with Russian President Boris Yeltsin yesterday, and the two top nations' foreign and military ministers agreed to meet in Finland in high-level efforts to resolve the standoff over Russian participation in the Kosovo force. Even as U.S. officials try to play down the impasse, they're dropping earlier assertions that it could be resolved among military officers on station in the Balkans. The moves in the United States and in Moscow amount to acknowledgement by both nations that the entrenchment of 200 Russian soldiers at the airport has raised serious issues concerning Russia's role in the 50,000-strong NATO-led force taking up positions in Kosovo. We're joined right now by two people to talk about Russia's moves. Katrina Vandenhoevel is with us, editor of The Nation and co-author of Voices of Glasnost, Interviews with Gorbachev's Reformers. And Nicholas Kozloff is with us, associate professor of economics at Hofstra University in Long Island, New York, who's written extensively about Russia. Katrina Vandenhoevel, can you give us your analysis of what the Russians have accomplished by taking the airport in Pristina?
On a political level, they've reminded us of, in stark terms, of how fragile and how bad U.S.-Russian relations have become and what an impact this war has had on the U.S.-Russian relationship. Clearly, we have a military in Moscow that has been humiliated over the last few years by NATO expansion, the U.S. role in the world, and is now fed up and unwilling to be carved out of Kosovo. Now, who knew what and when? We don't know who made the decision, but it seems likely that Yeltsin signed on to the decision, possibly after the fact, with the initiative almost certainly coming from the highest levels of the Russian Defense Ministry. What we don't yet know is whether Yeltsin was convinced of the wisdom of the action or whether it was an effect imposed on him. He has a restive military to deal with. Disagreement, something not well known in the West, is extraordinarily unpopular in Moscow. Chernomyrdin has no political standing, and the Clinton administration, the relations are almost entirely with this tiny and dying Yeltsin regime, which is in the midst of a ferocious struggle over succession, power, and property. And much of that is playing out in what we see now on the ground in Kosovo.
Nicholas Kozloff, you're a professor of economics. What does economics have to do, do you think, with what Russia is doing right now in Kosovo?
Well, the economic card is what NATO and the Western allies are playing against Russia. The multilateral lending institutions like the IMF and the World Bank are clearly very active in Russia, and that's the card that NATO is playing, hoping to keep Russia in check. But I think I agree with Katrina Vandenhoevel that that won't work.
Explain exactly what you mean by what the World Bank and the IMF are doing in Russia now.
Well, Russia desperately needs to, in order to maintain its credit standing in the West, to at least keep up interest payments on its international debt, including the international debts of the former Soviet Union. And in order to do that, they are going to require bridge loans from the IMF and the World Bank. And so I think the NATO and the United States are hoping that those necessities will keep Russian actions in check.
By saying that those funds would be denied?
Yes. Ironically, I think the bombing campaign against Yugoslavia actually served to help Russia secure its most recent tranche from the IMF. And so in that sense, it was counterproductive.
How did that bombing help do that?
As an appeasement. You keep quiet about the bombing and refrain from interfering in the campaign, and your SOP will be a fresh tranche from the lending institutions.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, the whole discussion that we're seeing that's taking place between President Clinton and Boris Yeltsin, a couple of conversations over the last few days. I mean, sometimes when I hear about this, I can only smile because the pictures we've seen of Boris Yeltsin sort of walking one way and then his aides twirling him around and walking in the other direction. How with it is he?
Well, more important, I think, is the fact that he plays a role as a referee among competing factions within this isolated, tiny circle of oligarchs who've now come back since the ouster of Prime Minister Primakov. And the decision to bring in Prime Minister Stepashin, whose entire career has been in the security forces, was one really to protect the power and property of this small group. Professor Kozlov talks about the economic card, and on one level, it's very true and very rational. On the other hand, there is the talk that there have been guarantees made to President Yeltsin and Chernomyrdin of not only financial loans for payback for going along with this peace agreement, but also personal guarantees of security, et cetera, for this small regime. The question is, there is a strong group within Moscow which also feels the West has not come through with any substantial amount, and that Russia, this is a dire scenario, might very well turn and decide it's going to sell more weapons or move away from the Western lending institutions and not kowtow for this money, which has been very small. I mean, Professor Kozlov, you're more of an expert on this, but in effect, the IMF has basically been sort of check-kiting, I mean, washing loans to come back directly into the IMF account, so there's been very little money.
No, exactly.
Going to Moscow.
There's a very real distinction in Russia between the financial sphere and the material sphere, the so-called real economy. And the IMF and the World Bank are very much geared towards the financial area. But Russians, particularly because of their Soviet past, in which economic planning was always done in material terms, are geared very much toward the real economy. I was in Russia a month ago, and I work with central bank officials and Ministry of Economy officials, and there's a real gap. The Ministry of Economics, formerly Gosplan, the State Planning Commission, is reverting very much back to thinking in material terms and to ignoring the financial component. No, Katrina VandenHeuvel was absolutely correct. There is a very large group in the government and non-government institutions who are perfectly willing to forego IMF assistance. And to internalize the Russian economic situation, go back to thinking in terms of material conditions. And with respect to the military, there are even now initiatives from the Russian government, which until recently has been paring down military spending. There are now initiatives to increase military spending, to bolster the military component of the economy. So I think this latest situation in Yugoslavia has been very counterproductive in terms of what the West wanted with respect to Russia.
I mean, in terms of, you know, we're seeing the culmination of years of the Clinton administration's policy toward Russia.
Katrina VandenHeuvel.
Which, you know, which began with the shock therapy program, which is one reason why anti-Americanism is at such high levels in Moscow, not just because of the NATO war against Kosovo or NATO expansion, but ordinary Russians think of the West now as complicit in the Great Depression ravaging their country and how they lead their lives. So the tragedy is we come to this point, this fork in the road in Kosovo, where again we see NATO, in effect, trying to dictate the terms with the Russians unwilling to be carved out. But one has to frame it in the context of a relationship that has deteriorated to the point it has. And, you know, one hates the term lose Russia because it is the Russians to decide their fate and their history and their politics. But it is possible that this administration will gloat that it has, quote, prevailed in Kosovo. But as we enter the 21st century, it has lost Russia. And
as I said, I was in Russia a month ago. I work with two fairly distinct groups of people. On the one hand, government and central bank officials. And on the other hand, with private commercial organizations.
Nick Kozlov.
The government and central bank officials, they and I have a fairly hands-off relationship in the sense that I'm not compensated for the work that I do for them. But when I work with private commercial organizations, I am remunerated. The persons in the private commercial organizations are, by and large, young, very Western-oriented. But last month, inevitably, when I get together with them, the question was, what are you people doing?
Have you lost your minds? In terms of the bombing?
Yes.
I think that's so interesting because in this country, so much of the commentary has been, we must wait a generation, but the next generation in Russia will be pro-Western and will be ours. But in fact, what we've seen during this war is how the anti-Americanism has spread across through this young group. Even those who've come to this country to study have been reported to be in demonstrations, you know, holding signs saying, you know, Madeleine Albright and Bill Clinton have done more to, you know, to destroy the possibilities than 10 years of the Communist Party's agitation. And there's an irony and a sadness to that because I think many of the young people, you know, wanted to carve out their own kind of, you know, Russian democracy. It's similar to what we've seen in Serbia, where the NATO bombing has done more to undermine 10 years of NGO civil society building.
Absolutely.
Katrina VanHeuvel, do you think in that elections both here through the year 2000 and also in Russia play in here at all in terms of what's happening in Kosovo?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, well, in this country, the elections such as they are, I mean, you know, Al Gore would have staked his campaign on the pillars of the Clinton foreign policy, which were a transition to free markets and democracy and making Russia a strategic partner of the United States. I think those two pillars have collapsed. I think in Russia, we're going to see, and the elections, ironically, are same in 2000. I think it's very possible that any real candidate, if there are elections, because it's possible that Boris Yeltsin will try to extend his term if he's still with us through a variety of means, any candidate will have to run on a far more nationalist and possibly strident anti-American platform and carving out a Russian identity and a Russian foreign policy.
Well, as I said earlier, even now within the Yeltsin government, there are pressures to increase military spending. So even the Yeltsin regime is being forced to adopt a much more nationalist orientation, much less a candidate who's going to appear from outside that circle.
And as you're saying, the bombing of Yugoslavia certainly helped to has certainly helped to escalate the nationalist feelings in Russia. Well, that does it for today's program, and I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor of The Nation, co-author of Voices of Glasnost, interviews with Gorbachev's reformers, and Nicholas Kozloff, associate professor of economics at Hofstra University. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Special thanks to Dan Coughlin in Washington, D.C. If you'd like to write to us, you can do that by email. Our email address is democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, broadcast from the studios of WBAI in New York.